Welcome to our video in the Community Information Toolkit series. In today's video, we're going to discuss advanced web content, moving beyond basic HTML. First, we'll talk about a variety of multimedia choices that you have: animated GIFs, digital audio and video, Shockwave, and streaming media. Then we'll talk about interactivity choices, ways that you can have your website interact with your users. Tools such as image maps, CGI, JavaScript, Java, ActiveX, VRML, and Shockwave. Finally, we'll conclude. Before we get going, we want to talk about file sizes a little bit. We're going to talk about all these different multimedia choices. We've got to keep in mind how big the files are that we're producing. 1K, or 1 kilobyte, is roughly 1,000 bytes of data. 1M, or 1 megabyte, is roughly 1,000 kilobytes. And 1G, or 1 gigabyte, is roughly 1,000 megabytes. And we can span all of these different file sizes when we're getting into the realm of multimedia. Bear in mind when you're creating these files that the typical modem today for dial-up users handles only 28.8 to 56 kilobits per second. And that's bits, not bytes. So think before you offer those huge files. Okay, Chuck, let's get going by looking at a few of the kinds of multimedia sites that are out there, sites that are doing a little bit more than just basic HTML. First off, we're looking at a page that actually belongs to me, Chuck.
Exactly.
This is my Internet license plate gallery. And what do we have here? We have up at the top of the screen one of those familiar infernal banner ads that you see all over the place.
Yep.
What technology is going on here?
Well, that would be an animated GIF. And the neat thing about an animated GIF is that once it's downloaded, there's animation, there's activity, but it's not requiring any more traffic on the Internet. So that's one neat thing.
That's one neat aspect of an animated GIF. Another neat aspect is they're very, very easy to create. It doesn't take a lot of work.
And most browsers show them quite easily, and you don't need any plugins.
Works in every browser. Exactly. So we're pretty high on animated GIFs. Now, if we look a little bit further down on the screen on this particular example, it turns out there's another animated GIF. And this is one that was created by my editor, Andy King, and I'm especially proud of it. This is a license plate gallery, so we want to have a motif of traveling down the highway. And this is sort of thinking out of the box. This is having a vertically running animated GIF that simulates the stripes on the road.
And there's even a tiny pothole in that little road there I can see as it goes
And up. Andy spent a few hours making this perfect.
Exactly.
But it is not high tech. It's really easy to do, and it makes a page that's really attractive.
Right. I think the key thing for a web designer is that animated GIFs can be used sort of in subtle ways to make sites alive and move. But they also can be used like a hammer and be annoying after a while.
So that'd be real subtle. Absolutely. Everything we talk about today can also be abused and misused.
Right. So what's your next site?
Well, let's just go on to perhaps the NIM Online site, if you could pull that one up.
Here we come.
Now, take your mouse, please, and move it over that menu bar.
Okay.
What's going on here?
Search, referrals.
Notice how the color changes on those buttons as you move over there. So what's going on technically here, Chuck?
Well, this is JavaScript. And again, much like an animated GIF, there is sort of, at this moment, there's no network involved.
We downloaded the page once.
The page comes down, and each of those are individual little GIFs. So there's 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14 GIFs in this situation. And there is a GIF with a black background and a GIF with a blue background. And inside your browser, as the mouse moves over, it switches the GIFs. And so, it gives active content without requiring any more download or some server expertise or whatever. And it's, again, supported by every browser very effectively.
And once again, the technology is pretty accessible, right?
Yes.
It's pretty easy to write a program that takes advantage of on mouse over in JavaScript.
Yeah, you go to some site that you like, you do view source, and you sort of figure it out and do it yourself.
So this is a technology a lot of you may want to tap into.
So what next?
Well, let's move on and perhaps go to GobbleCorp.
Oh, okay, GobbleCorp. Here we go. Let's turn the music on.
Now, this is somebody who's taking advantage of Shockwave and all of its glory, and in particular, Shockwave Flash.
Yep.
And some people argue this is sort of the next generation, and all websites are going to look like this. It's a lot more like what you see on television, where something's always moving on screen.
Well, it's also more like a video game, too.
A lot like a CD-ROM or a video game.
Now, this is a little harder. You don't just go and view source and slap up a Shockwave.
No,
this is a multimedia production. Somebody sat down and carefully animated each one of these things and put the sound and turned the background video, background audio on and off. But it is a very strong experience.
Now, this site, gobblecorp.com, uses this display as a way to get business. And in fact, when we loaded the site earlier before taping the video today, we saw a splash screen that said, "We've got too much business." So it's very, very effective in impressing people that this is a high-tech, great web design house.
Yep.
So let's finally go to one more here, Chuck.
Okay. Here we come. This site is a site from my course, EGR 124 Internet and Technology, and it's coming up now, and you'll notice it takes a while.
Yes.
It's doing things like Java and buffering stuff over the net for audio and video.
This is what I consider to be a very good website, IBM. The colors that they're using are very attractive.
And you've developed some software that will actually sort of synchronize the PowerPoint slides with the video.
Attention is very nice. Every month they change their website so that you get some new information. They don't change the way it looks, but they change the
Okay, Chuck, so what are some of the pros and cons of getting into this kind of multimedia?
Well, this takes a little bit of effort. I mean, video is sort of always painful. Audio came onto the computer scene 3 years ago, or your typical high-end computers, and now you really can't buy a computer that doesn't support audio. Video is not nearly as typical on computers. As a matter of fact, there's very few computers that are sent with the ability to capture video from a camcorder or some other device. And so you're buying $700 pieces of equipment to capture video. And you're learning things like how to do nonlinear editing to take coughs out and stuff like that. And so it's just a lot of effort to get something like this up at this point in time. Now, in 2 years, I believe it'll be trivial.
So it could be rewarding to do, but there's going to be a bit of a learning curve.
Right. As a professor, I like doing things first. But there's a pain associated with that. And so there's a little effort. And in a couple of years, it'll be very commonplace. But I think today it's a little tough still.
Well, now we've given you sort of the flavor of the range of options available in multimedia. And let's go and talk about some of the tools that allow you to play with these kinds of technologies. Okay, now let's begin to explore some of our multimedia options. But first, let's review what you can do in basic HTML. HTML is, after all, a very rich presentation language. And the simple use of HTML, plus some nicely prepared inline graphics, offers you many ways to control how your content is going to appear. HTML can be written on any platform, using a wide variety of authoring tools, and delivered by any web server. So don't disregard basic HTML and inline images as a way to prepare a really rich website. Before you leap into advanced content, think a little bit. In some ways, the internet industry is trying to force you into advanced content. They say you've got to do fancy things. They want you to offer more than just pointing and clicking. You have to have animations, sounds, and video for your site to be interesting. You have to offer sophisticated user interactions so that folks will be attracted to your site. Don't believe this. You can make a really compelling website without advanced multimedia or advanced interactivity. Before you leap into multimedia in particular, realize that multimedia is natural for some kinds of content, if you're interviewing people for oral histories, for instance. But capturing and editing can take time and skill. Multimedia requires more bandwidth to deliver than simple text or simple images. You need more capable servers to do some of the fancy multimedia options. And your users are going to have to install all of the right plugins. Before you leap into interactivity in particular, understand that interactivity is essential for some kinds of applications. If your site invites your users to enter events on an online calendar, you need some sort of a mechanism for them to interact with some sort of a database. Or if they're registering for a class or ordering a print brochure and so forth. But interactivity can require some programming expertise. And, once again, you have to have fancier servers and server software to make it all work. This diagram gives us an idea of sort of the range of options available to you. Since we're talking about web publishing, all of us are going to have some sort of a basic web server that can deliver static HTML pages. And so these are depicted as sort of green. This is for everybody. Getting into the amber range, things that most of us can do fairly easily, are image maps and animated GIF files. But when we get a little bit fancier, when we get into streaming media, Shockwave, active server pages, Java, and CGI scripts, then we realize we've got to make a little bit more of an investment. And so you have to make your choices here. You have to say, is it worth my investment up front, getting over the learning curve in order to play in these higher level technologies. We mentioned animated GIFs earlier, and I think Chuck and I agree that this is a very accessible kind of a technology. It's a simple way for you to add visual excitement to a page. Animated GIFs work in all browsers without plugins. You see them all the time when you're looking at banner ads as you search the web. Well, what is an animated GIF? Really, it's just a simple little movie. The GIF format, which was invented by CompuServe in its recent incarnation, allows you to have multiple separate frames and some timing information embedded in a GIF file. And if you prepare these carefully, they're not necessarily all that large, and they can be very effective for enlivening your site. There are simple tools out there that will allow you to build these files. You could assemble a video frame by frame using a draw program or a graphics editor, and you could translate as an alternative from an existing moving format into an animated GIF. But let me warn you, you don't really want to take your average large AVI file and turn it into an animated GIF. Oftentimes it's going to be ridiculously large and your customers are not going to want to click on it. Another thing you can do with an animated GIF is you can simulate motion. You can have an object that appears at different points within the frame and it looks like it's moving across the frame. Alternatively, you can use animated GIFs to do something along the lines of a slideshow. So here you fill the frame with one image and then with another image, maybe scenes around a university campus, for instance, and it looks like a slideshow is taking place. This can be very attractive and very effective. There are a number of tools out there to help you. An example that you can download over the net is ULEAD's GIF Animator 2.0. Let's shift gears a little bit now and talk about sounds on your web page. First, I want to talk about background sounds. These are sounds, or I might say noises, that play automatically when your page is loaded. I'm not particularly fond, personally, of background sounds, even though Microsoft and others want us to use the tags to implement them, because they tend to slow down the loading of a page. They can be frustrating to your users, and they don't necessarily add a lot of value. But for instance, when you go to a lot of travel sites, you'll find that you're listening to background sounds. In my opinion, background sounds are often a sign of some sort of an amateur personal page. What are your choices when recording audio? Well, in terms of media, you can use conventional compact cassette. The conventional cassette format that all of us use in our automobiles is quite convenient. And you can get a professional quality DAC for $300 or so. Digital audio tape, or DAT, is another format you might want to consider. This provides at least CD quality, and you can get a DAC for $800 or so. Minidisc is another format you might want to look into. This is Sony's format that really didn't go very far in the marketplace, but was recently reintroduced, and you can get Minidisc DACs for about $400. What are some of the applications you might want to do in audio? Well, oral history is a big one. This is where you might go out and find people in your community that have a story to tell about the history of the community or their own lives in the community. And simply by putting a microphone in front of somebody and asking the right questions and letting them talk, you can get some very compelling content. Sound via the internet is very well suited to voice, so you can deliver it very effectively. For voice applications, you don't need CD quality. You can sample at a lower rate than CD quality and still get very good quality of voice. So therefore, your users will be able to listen or participate in your site at slower speeds over dial-up modems, let's say. If you're going to do an audio project, be sure you get the miking right. Get a good microphone. If you don't do this, your audio quality is going to suffer. You can get a decent microphone for $50 or so at a place like Radio Shack or any electronics store. One of the things you want to be sure and do is put the microphone close to the speaker's mouth, just as we in our studio have lapel mics that we wear. You want to make sure you can set your levels appropriately. Now, lower quality DACs will not have a way of doing this, but if you have a professional quality DAC, it will have a VU meter that allows you to set the levels appropriately for your particular speaker and the level at which they speak. And finally, an important thing to do is test. Record a sample tape, play it back, and make sure that things sound good. Make sure it's not too low, make sure it's not too high. While you are doing the taping, listen over the headphones as you record. In general, using digital audio involves recording onto some sort of a tape and transferring to a PC. Most PCs and all Macs are going to have sound capabilities, and they will accept analog inputs. Now, you can either use a digital recording device or an analog device and play it back in analog into your sound card and then put it into digital form. High-end audio cards may also accept data in digital form, and that would be an advantage. Another alternative that's kind of interesting is to use your laptop or your PC and record directly in digital form. Here you just plug the microphone directly into the PC, set your levels, and record straight onto your hard disk. And this can be a convenient way to go. There's software out there on the net for editing audio. For instance, SoundForge XP from the Sonic Foundry is a good one. For about $50, you can get this piece of software and you can do things like remove coughs, delete unwanted material, reorder material, and do anything that a professional radio station might do in preparing an interview. So you would simply be able to go along and drag little pieces off the sonogram, reorder and re-edit, and do whatever you want. What are the formats that you encounter for audio on the net? WAV files are common on the PC. AIFF files are common on the Mac. But the dominant format on the web, I would say, is real audio, because this is a streaming medium. And what this means is that the file actually begins to start playing during the download process. And this is going to be far more efficient than having your user download a WAV file. When you have your user download a WAV file, you'll find that it may take many minutes of real time to download the file, only to play 30 seconds of audio. And nobody wants to go through that experience. So Chuck, tell us a little bit more about streaming media and why that's so important.
Well, Rich, streaming media is really important, as you mentioned, because you don't want to sit and wait 10 minutes to hear a 10-minute clip. You don't want to wait 10 minutes to hear a 2-second clip, and you don't want to wait 10 minutes even if it's a 10-minute clip. So you need to have a way of starting the clip and playing the clip while it's downloading. It needs to be compressed to be small enough so that it comes over a modem in real time, and then it has to be streamed so that it's played as it's coming down. Now, Real Networks is the most typical streaming media tool that you run across. It has 90% of the market share with real audio and real video. Microsoft NetShow is slowly gaining some share. The encoder that you need to translate this material to the RA and RM formats is free. You want a streaming server, and they provide a no-cost server for nonprofits and up to 60 streams free for others. And the site to go to this is www.real.com. Now, as we've mentioned before, putting video up on the web is much more challenging than audio. It requires much more bandwidth, although you can compress it down to 28.8 at a sacrifice of quality with real video. It's much more difficult to edit. The tools are more expensive, and you need more training to use them. You typically will show it in a degraded form, small up in the corner as we showed on my course page, quarter screen or less, 5 frames, maybe 8 frames a second. Movies and TVs have 24 to 30 frames per second. Now, there's a number of different video formats. QuickTime and AVI are older formats. QuickTime was developed by Apple, and it is used on the Macintosh and the PC. And AVI is Microsoft's format that's used on the PC. Both of these formats are designed to be played on relatively slow computers, so their compression and decompression is very simple. But they require a lot of bandwidth. They're really only practical for playing off of a CD, not at all practical for the web. MPEG-2 is an international standard that's used in television. As a matter of fact, much of the digital cable television that you see uses MPEG-2. The problem with MPEG-2 is it requires significant hardware equipment to both compress it and decompress it fast enough. So again, MPEG-2 is also a little tough to use over the internet. It's not as convenient. Using video on the web, you absolutely need streaming. If you take something like a QuickTime or an AVI, a 30-second clip might easily be 2 megabytes in size, and this might take 20 minutes over a typical modem. If you compress it down using real video or real audio, you can find that streaming works reasonably well over 28.8 or 56, as long as you're willing to degrade your video content. When you're encoding it, real video, you can pick the modem speed at the time that you're actually encoding it. Basic techniques to capture digital video. Well, you have your source. You can either take off of an analog tape, such as VHS or Hi8, or a digital tape. The key is to get as good a quality capture as you can. Even though you're going to compress this down, the better quality you get, the better quality the ultimate compressed video is going to be. You'll have to go buy a video capture card. There's seldom a video capture built into most computers, although some Macintoshes and some compacts these days do have the built-in. But a video capture card might cost you anywhere from $300 to to $3,000, such as a Target TrueVision or a Radius Moto DV. An option that's just recently coming, and Rich and I are now beginning to experiment with this, is IEEE 1394 FireWire. This is a direct digital connection that goes right from your camcorder to your PC. And because it's digital, it doesn't suffer from generation loss. You can also use a simple PC camera, such as a Kinectix QuickCam, or possibly a video camera from, say, Noga, like Video on the Go. When you edit digital video, you're really going to have to buy a good piece of software. You're not going to download a piece of software over the internet. Adobe Premiere costs around $500. It requires a very powerful computer. We use a 400 megahertz Pentium with a 100 megahertz bus, 128 megabytes of RAM, gigabytes and gigabytes of hard disk. It's got to be a fast hard disk. It used to be only SCSI hard disk would work, but these days, the Ultra DMA hard disks that are being put into the newest of the PC computers are adequate to handle the data rates. Now, sometimes you'll have historical media, sometimes you'll have live events. Typically, you'll find, I think, that most community information sites will go for historical multimedia. You may want to try a live event, but you really have to be ready for this. The software allows it to be encoded and streamed over real time, but you really need to be technically astute before you're going to attack this. You want to test everything before the live event because obviously if it's live, you don't get two shots. It's probably a good idea to record the event as you send it out so that if everything falls apart in your live event, you can always digitize it later when everything is working again, and away you go. It's important to test your multimedia. It's important to verify that it downloads properly. There are these things called MIME types on the servers that have to be configured properly so that it properly serves out your multimedia as multimedia rather than text or HTML or other formats. You got to be careful. These video and audio streaming tools are still in development, and the new versions come out quite a bit. So you want to test to make sure that it works on a modem. You want to test to make sure it works on a direct connect. You want to test to make sure it works on older sound cards, Windows 95, Windows 98, on a Macintosh, and see what it looks like with older monitors with fewer colors. And you also want to try old CPUs or less than 8 megabytes of memory. But you might find that those are simply not able to play some of the niftiest multimedia. So, Rich, we have an expert who's going to help us navigate these complicated waters of multimedia.
Yes, we do. An old colleague of mine, Eric Larson, now works as a multimedia guru for the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, and he's going to tell us a little bit about what he does with digital audio editing.
Great.
Started at a campus radio station. We did not have anything digital at that point. I spliced tape to edit production of a radio show. If I had had digital, it would have been a lot easier because I could have just in an editing window spliced in things rather than having to physically cut tape it together, which obviously compromises the integrity of a tape. When we move into the digital realm, we are representing sounds with zeros and ones. And there are certain parameters that you must use that determine how good the sound is going to be, the fidelity, the frequencies that are used in it. If you start with digital, if you record digitally, and you go into a computer that can handle a digital signal and edit it and end up mastering it digitally, you end up with no generation loss. In the beginning, there were AU files that the Next and Sun people were using, and we've turned more into WAV files on the PC, AIF files on the Mac. Fortunately, both Mac and PC can read each other's files. There's also real audio files, which are very good compression standards. They work very well for voice. There's also an MPEG file, and Windows Media also has their own compression types. For the highest quality audio you would need for a voice would be 5 megabytes per minute. Now that's at a sampling rate of CDs, which is 44.1 kilohertz. You could get by with less than that, probably. Maybe 2.5 megabytes per minute, 1.25. If you keep halving the quality, you can get more out of your hard drive. Human range of hearing is approximately 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz. So you can see where the 22,000 number will fit into the range of human hearing. Human voice, again, will have frequencies across the whole register, but they're more concentrated in the lower ranges, maybe less than 5,000 hertz. the range of options for media for capturing voice is dependent on how much money you want to spend. You could certainly buy a cassette deck and do a recording from that and then put that into your computer. It'd probably be better if you got something like a mini disc, or if you could go all the way up to a DAT recorder. You can get one for maybe $500 all the way up to $2,000. It actually records digitally, which is nice. Obviously, a cassette deck is an analog recording device. There's also the possibility of recording directly into a PC. If you have enough hard disk space and you have the appropriate software and the appropriate sound card, you could record digitally that way, right to your hard disk. A laptop would be ideal. And if you've got a long enough cable, you could put the laptop far enough away that it doesn't make enough noise to get into the recording. Recording the voice is easier because, first of all, you only need to record one channel. You don't really need a stereo voice sound. And with digital, you really don't need as high a quality of a recording because the human voice does not contain the frequencies of an orchestra. You could certainly go to a place like Radio Shack and get some of their microphones. One I always recommend is called a PZM, a pressure zone microphone. Lots of people use them. They're about $50 or $60, run on a AA battery, and they would sell you the appropriate adapters that you could use. It's a very good mic for recording voice. Well, the idea of getting a close miking is that you don't get all the ambient noises in the room. If you have a mic that's placed too far away, you're going to get a lot of the other sounds in the room. And digital can do a lot of things, but it can't get rid of sounds like that very well. So you want to still get a really strong signal so that you don't have to adjust the volume, which again brings up the whole floor of noise. Most recording devices have what's called a VU meter. It's something that you need to monitor to see how much signal is going in. In the analog days, overloading the VU meters would result in sending too much signal onto the Mylar tape, and it would distort because the whole signal was not actually on the tape. In digital, you have a similar phenomenon, so you still have to keep the signals in mind. You have what's called a lot more headroom with digital, so you can go a lot further with louder sounds and a wider dynamic range. For a long time, webmasters were reluctant to put audio on the web because of the large file sizes, but now that we have all these compression schemes and formats, you can put audio on your sound on your page, and it won't increase the download time that much.
Thanks, Eric, for that lucid explanation. Now we have a little bit of irony here. I went to Chicago and I taped Eric using a DV cam, a digital video camera, and this is the camcorder that I used. And so we recorded this in digital media, and we went and we edited this in digital media. So Chuck, why don't you tell us a little bit about what was involved in doing that?
Well, the interesting thing is here's Eric talking about how it used to be terrible to edit in analog and how wonderful it was to edit in digital. And I'm sitting on my super-powered computer in my basement, and I'm editing all digital, and I thought it was a lot of fun. And I've had experience both editing video using analog techniques and using this digital technique, and there is just no difference. I mean, it's just not worth trying to do analog editing anymore. And it's sort of my feeling that roughly this is the future, and when this kind of equipment and capture equipment on our PCs is commonplace, that's when digital video and capture and digitization and streaming will be as easy as audio is today.
So you think we're going to see a lot more video on the web as time goes on?
I think, you know, in the next year or two, those will become more commonplace, they'll become more affordable, and we'll see a lot more video on the web.
But right now, it's a bit of a reach.
It is a bit of a reach. And if you want to be a geek and you want to sort of push the envelope, which I like doing, then by all means, it's fun to do and it works. But if you just want to, like, do work and get some web pages out, it's video
content,
a bit of a step. Yeah.
Well, next we're going to shift gears and we're going to talk about what's involved in interactivity on your website. Now let's talk a little bit about interactivity and websites. First off, I'm going to talk about something that's so simple, maybe some people don't even consider it interactivity. And that's image maps. You've run across image maps as you surf the web. This is where you have some sort of a drawing or a photograph, and if you click on one part of that drawing, it will take you off to another web page. If you're going to get into image maps, you want to design them such that you have graphic elements that serve as very visible buttons. People need to know what is a clickable item on your image map. Now, there are very simple tools that allow you to mark the boundaries of these buttons and build and define your image maps. With these tools, the coordinates of the button will be recorded in a little snippet of HTML that you can then paste into a web page. When a user clicks on one of these buttons, the appropriate web page will be delivered to the user's browser. Here's an example of a tool for Windows called MapEdit. This is a pretty simple tool, and you go and you click on one of the different kinds of shapes. You map out or show the particular shape, and you can do circles, you can do rectangles, you can even do polygons. You can go and define all of the different pieces of this bolt of lightning. And for each one of the shapes, it will ask you, tell me the URL that you want me to jump to when your user clicks on that particular item. It will then deliver you a little snippet of HTML that looks something like this, and it will define an area for each one of the particular items that you have gone and marked. Now, you will take this snippet of HTML and you'll put it into your web page, and in so doing, you have built what is known as a client-side image map. And browsers for the last several years have been able to handle this. They work very nicely. When your user goes and puts the mouse over one of these clickable objects, automatically at the bottom of their browser window, they will see the URL that they're going to jump to if they click on that button. Some tips about image maps. Make sure that these clickable areas are very obvious. Unfortunately, sometimes you go to some sites and they haven't done this. Your customer is going to want to know what is and what isn't a button that they can click on. Be sure that you embed the map tags and contents in the page, but also define what's known as the server-side image map. Also, always include an alternative to the image map. Now, a common way of doing this is to have text mode links, simple href tags, at the bottom of the page. This is useful, for instance, for visually impaired people who can't take advantage of a graphical image map. Okay, before we go further and talk about other forms of interactivity, let's think for a second about what's really going on as content is delivered over the World Wide Web. A user's web browser needs to know how to do two things in life. It needs to know how to go and get content from across the web from a server somewhere, and then it needs to know how to interpret HTML and make it look pretty on the screen. When we get a little more complicated and talk about tools like JavaScript, the browser also needs to know how to interpret that language. Generally speaking, in most simple cases, the server really doesn't have a lot of work to do. The server sits there and waits for content to deliver, waits for a request from the customer for a particular piece of content. However, when you have a complicated database application, the picture on the server side may get very more complicated. It may be quite a bit more sophisticated. And let's talk about the range of options that's available to you. What are your alternatives to static HTML? Well, an old venerable one is the Common Gateway Interface, and we'll talk about CGI a bit more in a minute. Then there are various ways that you can connect to a database. ColdFusion and Microsoft Active Server Pages are common examples. And then we have languages like Java and JavaScript, and finally we have this wonderful multimedia and authoring environment called Shockwave. What does CGI do for us? Well, if you have a very simple application such as recording a little bit of information that a customer has typed in on a web form, CGI is a pretty good way to get going. What you have to do is you have somebody write a CGI script, which is nothing other than a little program, commonly written in C or in Perl, and that CGI script talks according to the rules of CGI. It interacts with a server application. Your customer fills in a form, they hit the submit button, the data that they have typed in is sent back over the web to the server, and the CGI script processes the form, perhaps stuffing the data into a file or perhaps into a simple database. Now, CGI is very, very useful and functional, but it's the old way of doing things. You're either going to have somebody write your CGI programs for you, or there are various script archives that you can find out there on the web, and you can go and take other people's CGI tools and install them on your server. Now, implementation of a CGI script requires access to the root or administrator authorities on your particular server. An alternative to CGI is a variety of middleware tools. Cold Fusion from Allaire Corporation is the first of these to become popular. What you have is sort of a little extension to HTML called the Cold Fusion Markup Language. So you actually write little bits of code to talk to your database right inside your HTML page. And you can reference a database via this embedded code. That database might be Microsoft Access, SQL Server, Oracle, or any other kind of a database. And so here you have a way that you can both have the presentation aspects of your HTML page and the access to the database to pull out data and put data into the database, all embedded in one page. An alternative to Cold Fusion is Microsoft's tool, Active Server Pages, or ASP. This is Microsoft's solution for connecting your server to an external database. And ASP is really nice because it's integrated very nicely into the Microsoft Internet Information Server. Microsoft touts the VBScript language, which is somewhat similar to Visual Basic, as a nice way to get going in ASP. So you've got very easy installation and integration if ASP is the tool that you pick. Chuck, you want to tell us a little bit about some other tools?
Yeah, I would say of all the tools that you just got done talking about, people starting from scratch today would most likely probably choose Active Server Pages as their server-side tool. But continuing on the client side, we have other things like Java. Java is a programming language from Sun Microsystems. There are more computer books written on Java than any other language. Java programs are deployed as applets. They're prepared by a developer who's a programmer. The language is much like C++. It's not particularly easy. You must actually learn it. It's compiled into what's called a bytecode file. And then you reference this file in a web page. This bytecode file is then downloaded over the internet and executed as part of the browser on the user's desktop. Because it's portable, Java can execute anywhere that there is a Java interpreter, which means it runs on Unix boxes, Macintoshes, and PCs. The Java interpreter was built into Netscape Navigator version 2.0 and later, and it's also supported in Microsoft's Internet Explorer. Microsoft is pushing the ActiveX alternative, which is another way to put programs into web pages. ActiveX has the advantage that it can be used the same way in a web page as it can be used in Visual Basic or Microsoft Visual C++, which are other development environments. So if you're targeting a Microsoft environment, ActiveX has advantages that it's sort of a commonality between programming in a web page and programming in other languages. There are compilers and visual development tools available for several hundred dollars up to a few thousand. Now, a language that you'll probably run across more readily is JavaScript when compared to Java. JavaScript is a very simple language. The entire JavaScript program is typically embedded directly in your HTML program page. The program is interpreted by the user's browser as it's been downloaded. And so it downloads it, and then it's actually executed in the browser. Now, don't be fooled by the name. It's much easier to program JavaScript than Java. And there's a lot of payoff for simple applications. The advantage that JavaScript has is you can go to somebody else's page and you can view the source and you can say, oh, that's how they did it. You cut and paste the source and drop it into your own page, and with a few little tweaks you can make it work. You can't do that for Java applications. This is an example of a sample JavaScript program. This is going to say, when was this page last changed? At the top you can see, in the middle there, you can see script language equals JavaScript. We're going to hide this. Document.write, this is a JavaScript function call, quote H2, this page was last updated on, and then plus is a concatenation, string concatenation, and then document.lastmodified plus, and then a string. And so that's going to, when it executes in your browser, it's going to print the last modification date. So it's downloaded as it's shown here, but then as it executes, it will execute in the page and you'll see the last modification date. VRML is another alternative. VRML stands for the Virtual Reality Modeling Language. It's a language for building 3D worlds of cubes and circles, et cetera, and spheres, and you move through this world. You're allowed to navigate this 3D space as opposed to a 2D space that you would just move back and forth. Netscape Navigator supports it in version 3.0 and later. Microsoft Internet Explorer version 4.0 and later also directly supports what's called Active VRML. But this is a relatively obscure technology for what most websites. If you don't have a real reason for it, it's probably a good idea not to bother with VRML. Another common format is Shockwave for Director. It's a 3D authoring environment, and it's very, very popular for many years in the virtual reality community. And it's the authoring tool of choice for many CD-ROMs. It sort of built, it came out of, in many ways, the Macintosh community using HyperCard and Hypermedia. It's from a company called Macromedia. And there's a plugin called Shockwave 4 Director for Netscape Navigator 2.0 and later. And it provides the ability to play and interact in a director animation. These are, in a sense, like programs. There are games that are written in Shockwave, and you can interact with them. It's being used by many sites to animate their logos and also for more extensive applications, going from games to interactive maps and other things like that. Shockwave Flash was released in 1997. It's a re-engineered version of Shockwave for the web. They have a few thousand. Now, a language that you'll probably run across more readily is JavaScript when compared to Java. JavaScript is a very simple language. The entire JavaScript program is typically embedded directly, more efficient in terms of moving across the net than actually drawing the bit images. The advantage is smooth animations because it's moving objects around in the client side. This is really good. But the con is that you need the plugin, users must have the Flash plugin, and it still takes quite a bit to load. So Rich, you're going to bring this all back together for us.
Well, yeah, we've talked about a number of different opportunities we've got for getting going in multimedia and in interactivity. Software can make your job easier. You'll find authoring packages that help you get going on GIF animation or on image maps. You could use the Visual InterDev tool from Microsoft to build your ASP pages. There are a number of Java development environments from Sun, Borland, and other companies. And Macromedia's tool Dreamweaver has made quite a splash. A lot of people think Dreamweaver is a wonderful way to make rich multimedia pages for your website. One little piece of advice. Try to build your tools once and then reuse them. Build templates for your HTML pages and use the template page when you build a new similar page. Devise simple interactive tools in JavaScript and reuse those pieces of JavaScript. Treat them as modules and use them over and over again throughout your site. Create modules in Java or ASP for reuse site-wide similarly. Well, really today we've gone through sort of a hardware store full of tools. You could spend all of your energy and all of your time picking a tool or learning a tool, but remember it's important really here to balance your efforts with real content work. Pick one or two advanced tools, or don't be afraid to pick zero advanced tools. You don't have to get into this high technology unless there's a compelling reason to do so. So once again, let's look at our diagram of some of the different tools and choices you have in terms of technology. What do you think, Chuck? What do you think most sites need? Where do they need to be on this diagram?
Well, I think the way you've got it drawn there is about halfway up is the right spot. And I would include JavaScript on that bottom half. I think that static HTML, obviously. I think image maps, well supported. Doesn't matter what server you put them on. You could be hosting your own server on your own site, or you could put it on someone else's server. I think JavaScript is good. I think animated GIFs are good. And I think once you move beyond that, I think the next two things that you probably would add are perhaps streaming audio or active server pages. And so I think that you got a good set of right about halfway up that screen is where I'd call the cutoff point.
Well, I think we'd like to wish you luck making your technology choices, and we'll look forward to seeing your content on the net.